Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the ImpediMed Quarterly Results Investor Conference Call. All participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question-and-answer session. If you wish to ask a question, you will need to press the star key followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. I would now like to hand the conference over to Mr. Richard Carreon, Managing Director and CEO. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Rachel. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. We're hosting this conference call to discuss our 4C for the financial quarter ending 30 September 2020. Joining us on the call this afternoon is Tim Cruickshank, our Chief Financial Officer, and Mike Bassett, our Senior Vice President of Corporate and Strategic Development. I'll be referencing the 4C we lodged this morning, Australian time. At the conclusion of my remarks, we'll be taking questions. Today we'll be discussing our first quarter results for 2021 financial year. We have made great strides over the quarter, and we are confident that the key drivers are in place to accelerate the adoption of the SOZO digital health platform over the balance of the year and beyond. Although the company faced many challenges throughout the quarter related to the global pandemic, we saw a strong rebound across our entire business. The key drivers of the rebound were the addition of new cancer centers, expansion of SOZO in current key cancer centers, either by adding new devices and or the purchase of new indications, broader adoption of our newly introduced lymphedema prevention program, and the acceleration of patient testing. These all contributed to our growth this quarter. Total revenue was $1.5 million, up 11% versus the previous corresponding period, and up 24% quarter over quarter. SOZO revenue for the quarter was $1.4 million, up 45% versus the previous quarter, and up 29% quarter over quarter. SOZO SaaS revenue came in at $0.9 million, up 23% from the previous corresponding period, and up 1% quarter over quarter. When you exclude the impact of foreign exchange, SOZO SaaS revenue for the quarter was up 28% versus the previous corresponding period, and up 9% quarter over quarter. This equates to 12 straight quarters of quarter-over-quarter growth in the U.S. SaaS revenue. Annual recurring revenue topped $6 million. This was up 54% versus the previous corresponding period and up 15% quarter-over-quarter. Contracted revenue pipeline came in at $13.1 million, up 42% versus the previous corresponding period and up 20% quarter-over-quarter. SOZO patient testing reached record highs and have recovered to pre-COVID-19 levels with over 25,000 patient tests done this quarter. This is up 42% from the previous corresponding period and up 54% quarter over quarter. Through the end of this past quarter, SOZO tests has now exceeded over 150,000. AstraZeneca selected our SOZO digital health platform to be used in their phase 2 trial to measure fluid volume in patients with heart failure and chronic kidney disease. This contract is for a minimum of 175 SOZO devices to be used in 20 different countries over approximately 18 months. The value of this contract is over $2 million. We expect delivery of the devices to the clinical trial sites to begin this quarter with reoccurring revenue to Q2 FY21 and accelerate in Q3 of FY21. Other achievements for the quarter. Our contracted renewal rate was 100%, representing 17 contracts. Two of these renewals were significant contracts within large U.S. hospital systems with an average monthly fee increase of over 50%. A particular note. The power of our technology and the SaaS business model is providing a significant opportunity with existing customers through either new device sales as well as new indications, all of which increase the monthly licensing fees. And as we previously stated, our SaaS licensing fees bring with them gross margins of over 90%. We expect this trend to accelerate over the coming quarters. Our churn rate remains low at just 1%. And during the quarter, we sold 43 SOZO devices. This was a 105% increase in units sold quarter over quarter. This brings the total number of SOZO devices sold since our initial launch to more than 600. 10 additional devices were sold to Baylor Scott & White Institute for Rehabilitation, giving them 35 units under their program. AstraZeneca also purchased 6 units for use in a second study. We also introduced our fluid analysis software for heart failure patients after collaboration with Scripps Institute. And cash on hand as of 30 September 2020 was $15.4 million. We took receipt of an additional $1.4 million from the exercise of options issued to subscribers in the entitlement offer with the potential for up to a further $15.7 million to be raised by 31 March 2021. Now, let's talk about what we've achieved in our three focus areas. First of all, oncology. I'm pleased to announce the meta-analysis has been officially accepted for publication, and we expect its release in the coming weeks. We believe this paper will provide compelling level one evidence to assist with enlisting further amendments to the NCCN guidelines and with submissions to insurers for private pay coverage. Excuse me. In addition, an additional paper discussing the risks of subclinical lymphedema by the extent of surgery and irradiation has also been officially accepted for publication. We expect the release of this manuscript later this quarter. In heart failure, with the release of our new software, we anticipate the first commercial sales for heart failure this quarter. To be clear, we are engaging in an initial targeted sales approach focused on key centers in order to determine optimum patient flow. We continue to work with the FDA on removing, contraindications. So we continue to work with the FDA on removing contraindications for the use of bioimpedance spectroscopy with patients who have implantable pacemakers and cardiac defibrillators. And renal failure. The company delivered on the initial aspects of the renal failure strategy with the signing of the contract with AstraZeneca. The AstraZeneca Phase 2 trial will measure fluid volume in patients with heart failure and chronic kidney disease. The study will use SOZO to evaluate the efficacy, the safety, and tolerability of a combination of two AstraZeneca drugs in heart failure patients with chronic kidney disease. The company is also focused this quarter on the initial deployment of the devices to be used in this important clinical trial. And significant progress has been made on the clinical, regulatory, and commercial strategies. It remains a focus of the company, and we look forward to updating the market at the appropriate time. In closing, I believe we successfully navigated another very complex and challenging quarter under the cloud of a global pandemic. As I stated last quarter, we have transformed our business to meet the ever-evolving environment. We believe now, more than ever, that the past initiatives we put into place have placed us in a very strong position to thrive during these turbulent times. We left this past quarter with all aspects of our business rebounding. We have seen this rebound accelerate throughout the month of October. And to date has been predominantly lymphedema. From this quarter on, with AstraZeneca and the expected first hospital sales in heart failure, we start to see the sales growth driven from other focus areas. And though we still face the headwinds of COVID-19, we believe we will continue to see the adoption of our technology accelerate and to see the continued double-digit growth in the coming quarters. Rachel, these conclude my remarks. Let's open up the lines for questions, please.
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star 2. And if you are on a speakerphone, please pick up the handset to ask your question. Your first question comes from Shane Storey from Wilsons. Please go ahead.
Morning, team. Thanks for taking my question. Look, the first one I've got, Rick, is just on the installed base. So I saw 43 new devices there. I just wondered how many of those went into new accounts over the period.
Oh, yeah, Rick, gosh. Tim, do you have the number?
Yeah, hi, Shane. Yeah, yeah, we continue to see about two-thirds of our devices going to existing accounts.
Great. And when I look at that, I think you called out sort of more than 600 SIRZO units now. I mean, could you give a rough breakdown as to how many of those sit in the U.S.? That would just help with the modeling. Thanks.
Yeah, definitely. And we noted that as a question that was coming up. So in our latest investor presentation, which we posted last month, we gave that breakdown. It's roughly two-thirds of our units in the U.S. and a third outside of the U.S.
Great. Thanks. Look, I just wanted to see my second question, digging into the renal indication, please, just so I can understand the commercial plan I guess the question is really around understanding the target indication there, cognizant that you sort of don't have an FDA clearance there specifically for SOZO, but anticipate one. I'm wondering whether there's an interventional component anticipated to that, or whether we should think about this simply as, you know, measuring these quantities like total body water or dry weight with just a lot more accuracy and or convenience. If you could sort of just help explain that for us.
Yeah, the indication that we're looking at is really for either dry weight or overhydration. Those are the two critical numbers that these, how they manage renal patients, Shane. So they're looking at how much fluid overload that they have and how much to take off during that dialysis session. The belief is that they can get more accurate than just using the scale and observation, that they can actually improve the outcomes and extend the life and quality of life of these patients. So that really is what we're focused on now.
So should you be able to get that in a more timely way? I'm just trying to wonder how that sort of does improve the outcomes. And then maybe as you answer that, to think, because I'm sort of conscious that, you know, there's a dialysis center setting and there's a home care setting there that's probably available. And I'm just wondering, you know, whether there's any differences there in the way you sort of approach those. And then the reimbursement pools that I guess potential users can tap into.
So the opportunity obviously is with the dialysis center. That's where the vast majority of these patients are. There is a trend moving to the at home, but for both sites of service, home and in the clinic, it really is about the hydration issue, how much excess fluid they have and how much can they take off. And again, the belief is that if they have a true indication of fluid, that they can set the dialysis machine to be more effective, to pull off less fluid or more fluid given a certain period of time, and that these patients will get better outcomes. Now, the reimbursement has already been established for CMS. In the United States, for instance, over 90% of all dialysis patients are Medicare eligible. And so Medicare, the federal government, runs the program irregardless of what your age is in the United States. So it's one of the few exceptions where if you're a young adult, child, or an adult or elderly, that this is covered by the federal government. And those fees have already been established, and they continue to evolve. There's two things happening now. Improving the outcomes is what's critically important for these patients, and then trying to move them to an at-home setting. So there is a large initiative in the U.S. today of moving these patients at home so that they're more comfortable, that they're probably better tolerable of the longer sessions, and that they get the better outcomes at that point. So for us, it's getting the indications that's necessary, and it may take several steps for us to do that, but in the end, that reimbursement has already been established, and there's other opportunities to increase certain rates and to get new codes in, approved by CMS.
Great. Yeah, that's very helpful. Maybe my final question, just around regulatory, do you feel like you have enough evidence to support, you know, when you file for that clearance now, or do you anticipate that you'd maybe need to contemplate more clinical work?
Well, as I said, that I think this could be a phased approach. I think the regulatory hurdle in the beginning will be our device. Can you use it to remove fluid, excess fluid off of a patient? I don't think we're going to get dry weight out of the blocks here, but I do believe that if set up correctly, that you can get an indication or use for removing fluid off of a patient and then move longer term to a dry weight or an overhydration indication. We really see this probably as multi-step, and as we continue our discussions with the FDA, that will become more apparent over time.
Okay. That's all the questions I had, guys. Thanks.
Thanks, Shane.
Thank you. Your next question is from Ian Hyde from Keystone Wealth. Please go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for taking the call. Two quick ones. The annual recurring revenue and contracted revenue figures, do they include the AstraZeneca leases, or they're on the side of that?
Tim, do you want to handle that?
They include the initial expectation of annual recurring revenue over the next 12 months, and the total contract is in the contracted revenue pipeline. That's correct.
Okay, thank you. With the, you mentioned there's some contracts that renewed with a 50% increase for the license fee. Do we know roughly what those new fees are per device? And is that contract fee increase due to them taking on new indications or packages in the model, or it's just because they're seeing value and you can actually put a price increase? And on the back of that, do you think that would be where new contracts going forward will be signed at that rate?
Well, first of all, on a new contract, there's a number of ways for us to get additional increases with customers. First of all, there is a commensurate price increase. Remember, these contracts are signed for 3 years, for up to 3 years, and most of our contracts are now 3 years in. The other ways to do it is to expand our current footprint, which we seem to do on a regular basis, where they start with one or two devices and they eventually get more and more and more. And we just talked about the Baylor Scott & White Rehab Institute that now has 35 devices. So that's one way to get it, adding more devices in there for monthly fee. And then there's the indications, using more of the software. So every time you want to add an indication, then we add an additional fee onto the monthly fee. So it really would be a combination of all of those that I just described, the price increase, adding new devices, and adding new indications. And I can tell you that every quarter, every month, those numbers change and fluctuate. And we'll find a way to start reporting those. But again, this is the second quarter that we've reported 100% renewal rates, and we've always had 100%, but the second quarter we've given this level of detail, and we're very pleased with the fact that we're seeing these increases. Now, I can tell you that 50% of these two was very large institutions taking more devices and new indications. Last quarter we looked at the price increase came out at about 6% across the board. So I think you're going to see a combination. I think you'll see that fluctuate depending on which contracts come due that quarter.
Sure. Okay, thanks. And I know it obviously changes from contract to contract to some degree from what you just said, but do you have some sort of a ballpark figure as per license fee per device per month, just to give, say, some context as to what hopefully will be coming through?
Well, we haven't given that information. I think it's something we should consider doing based on what you're saying so you can help with your models. But again, we just started seeing, remember, that our devices have only been out there about 3 years, so we're just starting to see the renewals of these contracts over the last couple of quarters. And so I'm not sure 6 months gives us a good indication of how the future will be, other than the fact that we should start to see that on a regular basis. But let's do this. We'll take that under consideration and look at reporting some future numbers so it will help with the modeling.
Sure. Well, thank you.
And I would say, yeah. Rick, on slide 33 of our last investor deck, we do have a breakdown of a bit of the average fees that we're anticipating that we look to get for each contract. So if you go there, you'll find a lot of that information. We do target up to $1,500 on the first license and then continue to add licenses from there.
Sure. Okay,
so hopefully
thanks.
That would help with your modeling as well.
Yep. Thank you. You mentioned we had an increase with Baylor Scott White, but there's been no update with McKesson's. Is there anything available there?
We haven't reported anything. We continue to work with McKesson on a regular basis and hold regular meetings. And as that starts to evolve, we'll certainly be making announcements on that.
Sure. Okay. And lastly, there's 175 devices that's got to go through to AstraZeneca. How is the company's capacity to manufacture and install devices, scaled up? Because this is the biggest contract in one go. And then if everything else lines up, I guess you could say not really wanting to have a bottleneck that we can't go forward as quick as we'd like because we can't get enough devices out and installed from manufacturing, et cetera.
Yeah, let me tell you that we're feeling very good about our ability to scale up and to handle the contract. We're working very closely and have weekly calls with AstraZeneca. They have started to provide us the 175 locations they want these devices delivered to over a long period of time. And so we have a good idea of exactly where they'll start going, at least in the beginning. As they sign their contracts, their clinical trial contract sites, we get the information, we can ship them. And even we're feeling very good that even if we had a large influx, which we would love to be able to have, that we could easily handle the production at this point. We're in very good shape with our contract manufacturer, with our inventory of raw materials. And we anticipated going into COVID-19 that we wanted to make sure that we had inventories in case we did have some opportunities that we've been working on for a while come to fruition. So raw material, contract manufactured, and produced devices already, we're in very good shape.
Well, that's good to hear, but that's all from me, and thank you, and fantastic quarter. Look forward to more.
Thank you, Ian.
Thank you. Once again, if you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. Your next question is from Peter Gregory, a private investor. Please go ahead.
Hi, Rick and team, and good morning and good afternoon to everyone. Rick, firstly, congratulations on the AstraZeneca association. I think that's really great. But I'd like just to ask about that that deal. You mentioned there are trials in a number of geographies. That means the product's going to be used all around the world. Does this mean effectively that you've got a whole lot of demo sites being established in new geographies that you currently don't have any presence? And would AstraZeneca support the sort of demo site approach with their locations? And if so, are there coverage and support challenges that you might find difficult to work with and capitalize on the opportunities that might be there? I wonder if you could just discuss that with us.
Certainly. So the AstraZeneca, we've been working with AstraZeneca for more than a decade on a number of projects, very small projects, just our older generation devices. When they came to us with this large opportunity, we spoke to them about SOZO and how easy it was to set up, to train, to establish, and to test patients versus our older device with the gel-backed electrodes and having to have a specific waiting room and a highly skilled individual. That's really what sold them on the fact that we could support this large effort. It also shows that during COVID-19 that we were able to show them the number of devices we sold, installed, trained, and got information off of. And so we feel very confident we can support their efforts across the board, and we find remotely we can do this, and in all the countries are looking at, since our security is cloud-based and the cloud, the information is in that particular country, they're also feeling very confident of our ability to handle the large amount of clinical data that they will be looking at. So that aside, I feel very confident about that. Let's talk about what you mentioned earlier, Peter, when you said from a demo site. We wouldn't approach them about using these as a specific demo site where we could bring other physicians into to take a look at it, because this trial for them is a phase 2 trial, so obviously a very critical trial for them. And we wouldn't want to disrupt or interrupt the patient flow for their testing. However, think about it for a moment. There's 20 countries that this device is going into, which gives us footprint, and these clinicians, these nephrologists and cardiologists, are going to be looking at a new technology they've never explored, probably have never seen before. So I think that gives us a great opportunity to at least explore the option. Once we start moving through the process and establishing these devices, is there an opportunity for them long-term to purchase those devices when we terminate the lease agreement for that particular site? So I think there's a number of things we're looking at today that we think could provide some opportunities for us.
Yeah, no, thanks, Rick. That's really great to hear. Just one further question, if I may. Do you have any new projections on timeframe to profitability?
No, we haven't given any information on that, but I think you can see as our expenses continue to come down and our revenue, as we talked about, we continue
we've said that we will continue to see double-digit growth. So I think when you model it out and start to take a look at it, I think the analysts all have us out in FY22, I believe. So I think I would stick with what they're looking at.
Yep, no, that sounds great. Thanks, and keep up the great work.
Great. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Your next question is from Scott Power from Morgans Financial. Please go ahead.
Oh, g'day, Rick and Tim. Congratulations.
Hello, Scott.
On it. Solid result. Just one question for me. Just once the meta-analysis is published, can you talk us through the steps with the NCCN, please?
Certainly. So the NCCN has a what they call a face-to-face meeting once a year, and then they have regular submission meetings. And then anytime you have new data, you can supply that information to the NCCN. So depending on when we get our hands on the copy of it, we'll take a look at what's the best opportunity. I would foresee, though, that we're going to that we will immediately turn that around. And I think the principal investigator has already agreed to submit that on behalf of the analysis that his team has conducted to the NCC. So it'll go in for a regular review. We're not going to wait 6 months until the face-to-face review. We'll take it as soon as we can get it, and then we'll take the PREVENT trial coming out by Q1 of next year and send those results in as well. So we want to take advantage of this cycle of NCC, and we'll accept any paper that is groundbreaking or that reaches a significance to use that opportunity to file for a new to file for the NCCN to consider taking us on as a biopsy and spectroscopy LDEX in the guidelines.
Great. Thanks, Rick.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you. Your next question is from Martin Jacobs from Canaccord Genuity. Please go ahead.
Hi, Ricky, everyone. Congratulations on the result. I was just wondering, given that last quarter was impacted by COVID, or the June quarter, and this quarter you've had a significant improvement, but hospitalizations and infection rates are on the rise, are you seeing any signs that that this might negatively impact you again, or are you able to sort of just, you know, everyone's adjusted and you can trade through it?
There is a concern in the U.S. They're calling it a twin-demic, right? They're talking about flu season, and they're talking about the increasing cases rising. I can tell you that everybody in the U.S. has their eye on that. But we also said we have a unique ability to see when a site is starting to close down. Because our devices provide us real-time information, we review that data. I review that data on a daily basis. How many tests are coming in? Are they slowing down in any particular region? And we can shift our resources. What we've learned during the most difficult, challenging times, which was the March, April, May, June timeframe, is that by shifting resources and our ability to sell our product remotely, that we could take advantage or at least set things up. But we have seen some slowing in some markets in the U.S. where they've maxed out their hospital capacity for COVID-19 patients. And in other parts where they have seen a reduction in those cases or at least a flattening of those cases, that's what we're putting in our resources and our time. But I'd also mention during the call that we did see an increase, or we have seen a continued acceleration of that rebound. So for right now, we're feeling very good about the coming quarter, even if there is a big second wave, that we believe that we'll still have a very strong quarter.
Okay. And just following on from Scott's question around the NCCN guidelines, do you have any kind of revised timing expectations of when you might be successful with the studies?
Well, we think there's two key catalyst points we've talked about before, Martin. One, the meta-analysis is critically important because it does take a very large number of studies and a significant number of patients. And then with our own data coming out. So over the next, call it 4.5-5 months, you're going to see two level one evidence papers come out. And we are starting to get more and more interest by insurance companies. We just need to have this level one evidence. They've always said what's going to be important for us to have that final dialogue. So leading up to this point, we've used all the evidence that we've had, all of the information that we've had, and think about how fast we're still growing the business without widespread reimbursement. So we feel very good about that, that it will come. And to give you proof of that is we're starting to see some insurances provide, some private payers insurance starting to do pre-authorizations. So these are insurance companies that we're working closely with major institutions. We're helping them prepare the packages, and they submit these packages, and the insurance companies are approving these patients for a series of tests throughout their cancer treatment. So we're seeing that as the first break in the private payer. So again, we're feeling that this is an opportunity for us. We get this additional data that'll take us to the next level, and then the report out of the clinical endpoints for the PREVENT trial, we believe, should take us to the next level with private payers.
Okay. And just finally for me, on the FDA and removing contraindications, are you able to provide any more color as to where that stands?
Well, as you know, the challenge with the FDA on all of these things is we're now dealing with, you know, lymphedema is not life-threatening. When you take a look at possible interference with a defibrillator or a pacemaker, they take that very, very seriously. And so we have gone through a series of tests. We provided that information to the FDA. They continue to review it. They continue to ask us for additional information. And we're feeling very comfortable with the information that we've been able to provide them and the guidance that they've given us. They're just looking for, preponderance of data that would tell them that we will not interfere with a particular pacemaker or a particular defibrillator. Now, understand there's five major manufacturers of defibrillators and pacemakers. These are the main players, right? And they control a large portion, but they also have dozens of models between them. The good news is the FDA has not asked us for live patient model testing, right? They're asking for specific bench testing information that we have been providing them. So we think it's a matter of us just going through this and looking at the various pacemakers, defibrillators, getting them information. And so we will continue to do that and work with the FDA on this situation.
Okay, thanks very much for that.
Thanks, Martin.
Thank you. There are no further questions at this time. I'll now hand back to Mr. Carrion for closing remarks.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. We appreciate your continued support, and we're looking forward to the report outs throughout this quarter and with the meta-analysis coming up and with the radiation paper and so forth. So everyone, have a good afternoon. Have a good morning. Thank you.